September 2nd is the 70th anniversary of the official end of World War II. Today, we look back with the stories of those who never came home, those who did, and those who kept the home front running.
And she said, please tell the story so that people won't do it again.
I helped build them and I could repair them and everything. And I really enjoyed the work I did.
He said, do you know where the front lines are? No, but I'll find them, Colonel.
Whenever they said the war was over, I was downtown Champaign dancing in the street.
You know, you have to look at that generation as, you know, really having given so much.
This hour on WILL, we're looking back to World War II era Central Illinois as we mark the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. But first, the news. From WILL, this is a 70th anniversary look back at World War II. I'm Amanda Hunnickfort. We're going to start today about a three-hour drive northwest of Champaign-Urbana in Silvis, Illinois. There's a street there called Hero Street, though during World War II, it was still named Second Street. The name was changed in 1968 because the 22 Mexican-American families who lived there sent 57 men and boys to fight in World War II and Korea, a larger percentage than anywhere else in the country. Some combination of those 57 fought in every theater, in every major battle, and through them, author Carlos Harrison shares a vivid portrait of the war in his new book, The Ghosts of Hero Street.
As a writer, I didn't realize how rich the story would be. I fell in love with it when a former boss asked me if I'd ever heard of Hero Street. And I said, no. I said, let me find out. Thought we might do a story someday. We never got around to doing it for the magazine, but as I dug in deeper and deeper, I kept finding more and more layers of the story. And I couldn't have wished for a better opportunity to tell the story of so many aspects of the major battles and major units in the war, in both wars, in Korea and in World War II, and to also be able to talk about the way the country was evolving, because this is as much a story about civil rights and about our roots from the very beginnings, people coming from other places to make better lives, all the way through the war and how determined they were to prove themselves. And so it was a great, you know, you just can't ask for better material to work with. I couldn't make it up if I was writing fiction.
Truth is often better than fiction.
Yeah.
And I opened the book expecting to dive straight into Pearl Harbor was bombed, this is what happened, and you don't. You start with how these boys and men, how their families came to Silvis.
Yeah, and that was, you know, a fiction novelistic technique that I enjoyed using here, having the various subplots weave together. Because the central story, many may think of as the story of just the eight men who died. But it's really the story of the street, of, as I said, civil rights in this country, and really the way soldiers, the returning veterans, were the ones who gave us that transition, who said, you know, look, we fought side by side, and, you know, some of your sons are alive because of us. We ought to be entitled to the same opportunities. So it's a nice opportunity, and the very first chapter is about Hero Street itself and how long the battle had been going on to get it named Hero Street. Mm-hmm. But when I go back to Mexico, where these men came from, where the families came from, what better way to start than with a murder, you know? I think Raymond Chandler said, whenever things get slow, let a body drop. So it just worked out well.
Mm-hmm. And sadly, there were many who died that you covered. And, you know, as you said, there were the eight, but there was part of what made it special was there were so many more men and boys who went to fight on the street than just those eight.
Well, that's really what gave the street its name, and that's really what makes it historic. Many places had many of their sons go to fight, and many of their sons died. Here, however, for a place that was so very small, to have so many people go. I mean, you're talking about 22 families, and you're talking about 57 of their kids going off to fight. And when you think about those numbers, it's amazing. I mean, you know, one family had a total of seven of their children going off to fight at different times and different places and different wars. And you think about that, it's a phenomenal number for a place that's only a block and a half long. And that's where Dr. former Mayor Joe Turan has continued his struggle to get recognition for what had happened, where the Department of Defense said, you know what, you're right. There is no place that has sent so many to fight. And so that's how it became Hero Street.
And it is kind of surprising that more of the men from the street, that more came home, because as you wrote, tours of service were set for the duration of the war, plus 6 months, and the men soon learned that there were only three ways to come home: win, die, or be so badly wounded they could fight no more.
Yeah.
Wow, that's...
Yeah. Well, you know, it's scary, and I often, during the writing of this book, as I dug deeper and I did more research and I heard about the harrowing circumstances that they were going through, I had to question if I would have the courage to do it. From this vantage point, you know, I was in the service, I did my thing, I didn't have to go fight in a war. I don't know that I would have the courage. My father, as a matter of fact, was a tail gunner, like Tony Bompa was, on the same kind of airplane, same kind of bomber. And when I talked to the pilot and the bombardier who survived the shoot down that brought down that plane and Tony Bompa brought about his death, as they described what they went through, I honestly thought, okay, I might go the first day, because you really don't know what's coming. And when you get caught in that very narrow corridor between where the anti-aircraft guns are exploding their bombs, and you're trying to get away from the flak, and you've still got those fighter planes coming at you in wolf pack. As the pilot described it, he goes, you know, I really didn't have time to pay much attention because I was trying to keep the plane on its path. But as you could see the machine guns that flickered like fireflies as they were coming, the strafing coming at you. And I thought about it. I thought, okay, maybe the first day, because you don't know. But when they come to you the next day, you know, 2 days later, as every other day they flew, and they say, okay, let's go do it again. That's got to take an awful lot of courage to get up. One of every two men who went up in the air for the United States and those bombers died. One of every two. These guys flew a minimum of 25 missions. Many of them flew many more before they came home. So, and as they said, there's always the debate between, is it worse to be on the ground? Is it worse to be in the air? And the people in the air say, you know, the thing is, we don't have a foxhole to hide in. We're just up there and getting shot at. The guys on the ground can always say, yeah, but we don't get to leave. Once the bombing mission is over, these guys get to turn around and race like crazy to get home. The other guys who were on the ground, you know, the fighting would go on for day after day after day after day. And then once that battle was over, they'd move to the next place to go into another one. So it's true. War is hell. And I learned that over and over again as I worked on this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it became clear to me as I read just how much of the whitewash history book account we learn now, and how much each generation we're losing perspective and scale of what these men went through. Your book does a good job of filling in many of those details, battles that don't make the textbooks. You also talk really clearly about the misery of the war when you describe that typical day during the stalemate at Anzio Beach.
Yeah, Anzio Beach, yeah. It's you think about what they went through and the things that they saw. The bombardier, again, talking about him, his wife told me, and he admitted it, that every day, every single day since he came home, he would wake up at some point in the night screaming and in cold sweat because he was still trying to save another one of the guys who was on the plane. And you think about the things they carried around with them. There were many of the survivors were never whole again. Some would describe that sometimes when they saw the fog in a forest, that they'd grown up in and by their homes. Previously, things were beautiful there. But after they came home from the war, they would hear a crackle of a branch somewhere, and it would mean the enemy was coming, and they would just crumble into tears and fear. So it's something that they carried forever. And very, you know, you have to look at that generation as, you know, really having given so much. And now we have another generation that's over, many of them still overseas and have gone through so much in Afghanistan and Iraq. And those men and women are coming home carrying around their own images that they can never get away from, the nightmares. And, you know, I think that we need to make a real effort as a country to not just forget them and not try to wipe away the past, but to try to help them come home, because often enough they get home physically long before they can get home emotionally.
Right.
A friend of mine said to me, who had no conception of war whatsoever or anything that went into it, as she was finishing up the book, she said, "My God, Carlos, does everyone have to fight that fiercely?" And I said, "Only the ones who want to survive." Because that's really what it takes. It takes that complete commitment to do whatever you have to be able to come home and to be able to, at the same time, where a challenge comes in, is trying to, as best as we can, uphold the reasons that we are fighting. When the troops made their way to the concentration camps, someone put it very, very well and said, many of the guys knew what they were fighting for, but now they could see why, because they could see how brutal and how vicious the enemy really was. And even though the bombardier's wife says near the end of this book, you know, she goes, they called it a just war. And she says, it might be a just war, but it's certainly not a good war. There is no such thing as a good war. And she said, please tell the story so that people won't do it again.
We're going to hear now from a Champaign Urbana man who served in World War II. Corporal Sam Weldon was 18 years old, walking down West Church Street in Champaign, when a recruiting poster caught his eye.
One day I was walking down on West Church Street by my church, and it was a late winter day. I was going to the U of I, and I walked down to the Springer Building, which was our post office, and there was a sign, and it was blowing. There was a picture of a guy, says, "I need you." And in the next sign is a picture of a Marine on a desert island with three beautiful ladies. And I thought, that's for me. I wanted to go in, but my father had a friend on the draft board. He says, tell him to stay in school because he's going to be gone by the last part of December. Rather than to have family argument, I stayed. But then when I got up in Chicago, where they gave you the exam, you had to ask for it. Which line is the Marine line? Sergeant there. Right there, son. The exam was in December of 1943.
He was part of the second wave to land on Iwo Jima, and once he got to the war front, Weldon found a very different reality than that recruitment poster.
One morning I could hear a bunch of explosions, and I woke up at 2 in the morning. And when it began to get light, I looked out, and I couldn't believe what I saw. And I called my friend. I woke him up. There was 800 or 1,000 Army vessels, battleships and cruisers and gunboats, and they were all shooting. They had been shelling this island for maybe 72 hours. The Air Force had been bombing the island for maybe 72 days. We didn't know it, and the intelligence didn't know it, but the Japanese had tunneled the island. In all the previous battles with the Americans, that when you get out of your boat, they mention it right away with shells. And the Japanese general had made up his mind he was going to let them in. So he let the first wave come in, and the first wave, we can hear the radio coming. Very light resistance, and that didn't sound right to me or any of the other guys. So this amphibious tank took us down the beach about 30 yards, dropped the ramp in the back. We ran around both sides, and I guess we ran 15 yards, and then, boom, the first shell hit. All I can remember is I going up in the air and a terrible pain in my ear, the concussion. And I got up and off my hands and knees like somebody hit me in the jaw. And I saw my friend, and there was my best friend laying there. I couldn't see any wound. I couldn't see any blood. And then about the time I was going to roll him over, a beachmaster who was a major, "Get off the beach, get off the beach, get up. They'll kill you here. Get in there underneath the shell." So we took his weapon. He had a mortar on him. And I grabbed a friend of mine who was, he was a cook. But the cook's the ammunition carrier in battle. So we ran up away, and I found a great big shell hole, and we drove down in that shell hole. The beginning, the first days in the battle, everything goes wrong. So we got in this hole, and we faced what we thought was the front line, and pretty soon, within an hour or two, here come our tanks. And there was a brave Marine leading the tanks. He was guiding each tank this way and that way and that, because there are all these shell holes. Once the tank gets in a shell hole, he's done. He can't get out. So pretty soon, the first tank must have hit a place where they couldn't go any further. And here's this line of tanks. The Japanese began to shoot the tanks. They knocked one tank, two tanks, three tanks. And I mean, just blew them up, see? And everything that's missing the tank is going over to the other side of the hole. And I shake my friend. "Look at this. Steel was just raining in this volcanic ash. You couldn't believe." Some of the shelling stops. This begins at mid-afternoon. We go in at 9:30 or 10 o'clock, and come to find out, we didn't know. The front lines were behind us. We were laying out in front of the line between our lines and the Japanese. So we got up. I had a mortar, and he had some rounds, and I had my rifle, and he had his. So we started, I don't know how we did, we finally found the company about 3:30 in the afternoon. And hey, everybody was glad to see everybody else. And then my friend was a radio operator, had a great big radio on his back with a big antenna. And he says, "I just got a call from the colonel. He wanted to talk to the company commander." And I told him the company commander had been wounded and was evacuated. And he says, "Well, just let me talk to any company officer." "Sir, we don't have any officers. They're all dead or wounded and evacuated." "Well, who's running the company?" "The top sergeant, sir." "Well, who's running the platoons?" "The sergeants." He gulped a little bit. He says, "What's your name?" "Sir, my name is Keith Kerr." "Please don't get wounded. You're my only contact with the company." He said, "Do you know where the front lines are?" "No, but I'll find them, Colonel." He says, "You go up there and tell the men to make a skirmish line. One Marine, one facing the enemy. And then, right before it's dark, dig in. And when you dig in, expect a night attack. That's what Japanese like to do."
They did what the colonel asked, and when they were in position, one of the sergeants began roll call.
Called 250 names, and one of the first names he called was Nichols. I said, "He's dead." "How do you know he's dead?" "Because he got his face blown off, Sergeant." And come down and got all the names, and he said, "Boys, we're in a lot of trouble. We have 99 men left out of 250. Now, not all were dead, but if they weren't dead, they were wounded and out on the hospital ship. So we dug in, and then we didn't have any attacks the first night. So we stayed there two or three days, and then we got some replacements. There were young guys like us, and some of them had never been in combat. Some of them had never even been out of an office. They come back about the third day or fourth day, and they says, "We're going to move up in the morning, so be ready." So at the crack of dawn, our artillery starts firing. Bam, 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 bam. And I mean, they really fired a lot of rounds. And then after when the artillery's done, you get up and you go towards the Japanese line. And we met very, very stiff resistance. And so, gosh, I don't suppose we went a few days, a few hundred yards. And third day, it got dark. And he says, "We don't have enough men to hold the front lines. L Company is going to come in here. You guys just start moving back." Well, we moved back 30 or 40 yards, and we just got settled. "Boy, at least I get some rest tonight." All of them said the same thing, and I heard this video. "Weldon, take your squad and go back to the front lines. L Company does not have enough men to cover the lines." They had casualties bad also. So I took my one guy with me. The rest of them, I had to stay back there. And you could see, they actually see the enemy out there. But they were just as smart. Don't shoot at them unless they shoot at us. Because if you don't, they'll be able, they can tell where we are. So we stayed up there, and I had a Marine with me who I didn't know. I stood my watch, and I said, "Frog, it's time to come out and take watch." So he didn't come. I went back, and finally, and I'm not proud of it, about the third time I had been on the watch, my shift, and an hour of his, and I just took my rifle, and I hooked it in his nose, and I said, "You're coming out to watch. It says, my life is just as good as yours. So I made him go on watch. And the other two Marines who had been in there an hour that was sitting out with me, he said, well, he was shaking all over. He never would have come out unless you forced him to come out. And it made me feel bad. But later on, in 1946, I was living up on the north part of Champaign. And I went home one Saturday afternoon after work. And there's this truck sitting there and it says, Iowa. I don't know anybody from Iowa. And I went around the corner of my house. Here was the guy, the same guy. My wife and I put him up. We fed him. He never mentioned what happened, and I never mentioned what happened because, hey, that was a long time, 1940. This was 46, and hey, a lot of guys died. It was so bad that the band was the burial detail. Could not pick him up by hand, you know, carry him with a stretcher. They got trucks, one driving the truck, one guy up on top of the bodies, two guys pitching the bodies up. See, it was a health hazard. You couldn't leave the bodies out like that. No way. And the planes would go over and they spray DDT, all that stuff to keep the disease. And that was a terrible job. They drove them back. The bulldozer made a nice path out, and there was a rabbi and a priest and a Protestant minister. They wrapped them in a poncho. They took their dog tag out, said a nice prayer, and the bulldozer come along and bulldozed them. It was for health reasons, too. If I was 18 today and there was a war on, that would be the same thing. I'd do the same thing. To me, it was the hardest and the toughest and the meanest. And yet, when you get done, you know, just like a guy called me a year and a half ago, and he says, hey, how would you like to join the Marine Corps League?
Corporal Sam Weldon did join the Marine Corps League. During World War II, he served in the Pacific Theater as a member of the 4th Marines Division. He was part of the second wave to land on Iwo Jima. In a neighboring but less well-known theater, known as the China-Burma-India Theater, or CBI, Frank Sandoval, one of the men from 2nd Street in Silvis, Illinois, toiled as an engineer, a little celebrated but vital role. Author Carlos Harrison picks up his story.
And what happened to them, no matter what your job is, you're fundamentally a soldier. And so in his case, these were engineers who were called in to build a road of what was thought to be a very important supply line. We have to remember that at that time, during World War II, the Chinese were our allies. They were under attack from the Japanese, and we were trying to team up with them to help them in their fight against the Japanese. And so basically what Frank's job was to build a road. But it happened to be a road in an area of the world that's infested with poisonous snakes, with tigers. And they learned how to cope with that, and with leeches that would suck their blood. They actually made friends with real live headhunters who were known for chopping the heads off of their enemies. And they went to fight. But again, you know, his job was construction until they were needed. And then suddenly they had to pick up guns and they had to go fight again in a place where men were suffering so bad from dysentery and disease and fatigue that they would fall asleep in their foxholes and drown because of the rains. That's when they were called in to fight. And these were guys who, you know, had probably not fired a weapon since they left boot camp. And many of them died there, but they had to hold what was a crucial battle.
Frank Sandoval and the other engineers were helped by a colorful group of pilots who also fought in the China-Burma-India Theater, called the American Volunteer Group.
I mean, they were over there in the China-Burma-India, the CBI, as they called it. And actually, the startings of them were volunteers. And they put their planes together and they wanted to fight. And because they were volunteers, they really didn't answer to the military. They were supposed to deliver supplies. They were supposed to fly the hump, as it was called. And the hump is basically taking a plane beyond, at that time, what was really its limits, go over the top of the Himalayas, or Mount Everest and that, and come down on the other side to be able to deliver supplies and avoid the Japanese on their way. And they actually, they would do so many interesting things. There was really just a couple dozen at one point of these planes that they were using for cargo planes. And they're cargo planes, so they're not really outfitted to fight. But these guys would get stinky drunk falling down drunk, they would fly over Japanese targets and shoot at them with hand pistols. They would drop cows on them to irritate them and kill them. And they would repaint their planes and their propellers about once a week. And they had the Japanese convinced that there were hundreds of these planes, because every time they saw them, they were different. And they didn't realize that it was the same plane just getting a paint job and coming in to fly the same thing over and over again. And they just succeeded at craziness for the longest time. And I was lucky enough to speak to a couple of them. And it's the stories they tell about going out and doing things that in any regular military unit would have them up on court-martial so fast that they would never see the inside of a plane. But they just, you know, they did whatever they wanted. And so, yeah, flying drunk, dropping cows, and firing pistols at the enemy. The danger, of course, was if you got shot down over there, you didn't just have to worry about the Japanese tracking you to very likely kill you and at best drag you off to what was some of the worst camps that you could ever be imprisoned in. But you had to survive, as I mentioned, the tigers and the poisonous snakes and making your way out of an incredibly inhospitable jungle to try to get back. So it's, you know, those guys, they sure know how to make fun out of have some fun in a horrible situation. I'll say that for them.
That was author Carlos Harrison telling us about the American Volunteer Group that served in the China-Burma-India Theater during World War II. Harrison's book is The Ghosts of Hero Street. You are listening to a WILL special paying tribute to the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. We need to take a break now, but we will be back in a minute, so stay with us. Welcome back. This hour, we're revisiting World War II-era Central Illinois as we mark the 70th anniversary of the official end of World War II on September 2nd. I'm Amanda Hunnickfort. We've spent most of the show so far abroad with the men of Central Illinois who served in World War II, but life went on here as the home front turned their energies towards the war front. And Kathleen Ann Rook was one of those people. She says life in Champaign-Urbana was very busy throughout the war years.
Life was very exciting. We had an army up Chanuteville, and we had Navy on the campus. They were in training just like Chanute.
At the time, she said, the USO was where the Neal Street Champaign post office was, and it came to life.
It was really exciting there. They had a dance every Sunday night, and then we went to Chanute on the bus and to the dances up there. There was a band there, always a band, and we danced. We did a jitterbug. We danced with everybody that would ask us. I always said I wouldn't go dance with anybody if they were shorter than me. And I was 5'5", but I did. Up there on that ledge up here,
mm-hmm.
President sent me that plaque.
Oh, very cool.
300 hours of volunteer. It goes back. I had four brothers in the service, and my brother-in-law and my husband. There was six people was in World War II, six men. My husband was in the army at Chanute. He was in England for a while, and then he was in Florida. All the time, he wrote me almost every week, and I wrote to him and sent him packages and cookies. We made cookies and sent overseas when he was in England and France and all over, and did things like that, you know, to help him get through the war. They all came home. Yeah, and my mother prayed and prayed, and my mother was a minister, and she prayed and prayed for him, and they all came home.
The most memorable day of the war, though, was the day she heard it was all over.
I was downtown Champaign dancing in the street. I went out there and I started dancing, and I was dancing with everybody, and everybody was dancing, and they were drinking, you know, whatever we drank then. I guess we drank Coke, and, you know, we weren't supposed to be drinking alcohol. So we just had a gay old time when we found out the war was over. Oh, a lot of things have changed since then. Safer they have forgotten the people that has lost legs and, you know, lost hands. And when you go through the war, sometimes, you know, you get wounded. So you have that to cope with.
That was Kathleen Ann Rook sharing her memories of World War II. Rook still lives here in Champaign-Urbana and has many more stories to tell. Alice Lane was one of the many women who went to work in the factories. Her first job was at a General Electric plant.
I worked on the first 10 Kier units radar that was to be used on ships. And they placed me at number one on the assembly line, which was just to put a little rim around. But I helped build them and I could repair them and everything. And then I went back and worked in Syracuse at a Krauss Heinz, painting things they used for identifying whether their ship's friend or foe, used khaki, you know. And I worked there 6 months.
After working on the painting line for a while, Lane saw an ad for a division of the United States Naval Reserve that consisted entirely of women, called WAVES, or Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service. The allusion to the ocean waves was intended. She joined and was sent to Hunter College for boot camp.
We got 1 weekend off, but the Paramount Theater studios was filming the movie Here Come the Waves. So I got to march 2 weeks, which was really hot. Girls fainted.
After training, Alice Lane was sent to a facility in Trenton, New Jersey, where she was to install radar into the planes.
But I was lucky I got radar, which I had asked for. The first day I had to make coffee because the chief was really mad because we came in. We were the first waves. So he made us make coffee. He thought that's what we were going to do. Anyway, he got shipped out in about a week, and we put radar in the TBM. TBM was General Motors. I had to climb up on the planes, the wings, to get in the back, you know, where they put the radar. And the Avenger and the Wildcat, which is FM2. And then I checked the IFF gear on the Corsair. I fussed at them to let me go up in the TBM. And every time the aviation radio man would go up with the mechanic, but this time they had to go back up. So they didn't have to have the radio, and so they let me go up. We had a lot of waves there working in the supply and different departments. And when we weren't working on the planes, when it was raining out, they made us paint. Navy paint inside the hangars.
Were you painting the planes as well?
No, just the hangars.
The hangars.
And they also let us go to, it was war, you know, but we never got papers, so we didn't even know how much, you know, how it was going, really. I didn't even know D-Day was, because I was traveling. I went to Hunter College when D-Day, so I didn't know much about that. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the work I did. One time I had to weld. They were putting something together, and they asked me to go, and I helped them. It really, I thought, was really enjoyable.
Alice Lane left the service in March of 1946 and went to beauty school on the GI Bill. She later worked at the Urbana School District for over 20 years. We're going to go back to Silvis, Illinois now, the home of Hero Street, and researching the stories of those who went to fight from the Mexican-American community who lived there. Harrison also learned about life was like back home on what was then 2nd Street. Harrison's research started with a total of 2 magazine articles written about Hero Street, one for Reader's Digest and the other for People magazine. Much of what he learned came from talking with the families, though.
I was able to talk to them about what the boxcars were really like and the fact that the snow blew through the walls because there were so many cracks in the walls, and how, as Al Sandoval put it, you know, they didn't have indoor plumbing. So in the wintertime, you really had to make sure that you did all your business before the sun went down, because you didn't want to make the trek to the outhouse in the middle of the night in knee-deep snow. And I can get that. I can understand why he would want to avoid that. And sadly, too, because they were different, even though they were doing a job that they had been invited here to take, many of them remember being called names as school children, being shunned by the others, being mocked for being both poor and for being darker skinned, and seeing the Ku Klux Klan crosses burning on the hill above the street. Hero Street, up until 4 years after it was named Hero Street, was unpaved. It would turn to mud in the spring and in the rain. And so if somebody was going out, they'd have to wear one pair of shoes to make their way down the hill through the mud, and they'd be carrying the shoes that they were going to wear in a bag so that they could then put them on and go out on their date or go to work or wherever they were going, so they wouldn't show up in mud cake shoes. So those were the stories, plus the funny stories of kids being kids growing up, their crab apple fight. Everyone on Hero Street were so wonderful. They opened their homes and their hearts to me and shared their stories and their letters and their mementos and their photographs. And they put up with all of my incessant questions. There was a specific incident. Willie Sandoval's brother, one of his brothers, Al, he'd been so helpful and so wonderful to me. I really felt like I was part of his family, and he had welcomed me into it. And he came down, sadly, with liver cancer while I was still finishing the book. And I realized that the rate at which it was progressing, he wasn't going to make it. But I was able to send him the chapter about Willie at Anzio, and where they got the nickname, of these paratroopers got the nickname the Devils in Baggy Pants, because they snuck across the lines and wreaked havoc on the Germans. And the Nazis, they found in one of a German officer's diaries that he described them, that they would come in the night and they would leave the victims for the others to find. And they called them Devils in Baggy Pants because of the way they bloused their pants at the bottom. I wrote that chapter about Willie at Anzio and everything he'd gone to get through to get there. And I sent it to Al via email. And he called me the very next day, and he said, "Oh my God, Carlos, how did you find all this out? I didn't know any of this." He said, "You know, for a day, you made my brother live again. Thank you." And that was really touching to hear that from someone who I cared so much about, that I felt that I was accomplishing my goal, and that was to let everyone see how these people lived before they died.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It was also interesting, you know, as I worked on this book, it's funny because the tradition doesn't end. That military tradition, that service to this country, I can't tell you the number of times as I talk to families and relatives on that street, how we'd be talking about someone who had gone off to Korea or World War II or something, and they'd say, "You know, my granddaughter is in the Navy right now. And you know, my brother, he was a career Marine." It's still there. I think someone tallied up through Vietnam. The numbers through Korea was 57 that had gone off the fight. By the end of Vietnam, it was over 120-something. And they've had their kids go to Iraq and Afghanistan and continue.
Even after all that service, none of the men from Second Street used the GI Bill to go to college when they came home from World War II. It just wasn't their way, Harrison says. Of course, he mentions, at that point, college was not nearly as common, and good jobs were much easier to come by without a college diploma.
Their way was, they would have continued on at the railroad, most likely, had there not been a war. And then as these other companies grew up around it, John Deere and International Harvester and that, they would have found jobs there as they did. But these are working class people. They are people who, they go and they do their thing. many of these young people have to remember the poverty that they were growing up in also. It was quite common for them not to finish even high school. It was quite common, even if they were finishing high school, to miss huge stretches of time because it was onion harvesting time. And their families, they could make some extra money by going out and picking up those bushels of onions. And so they'd go over to Bettendorf across the Mississippi. Back then, the idea, many people just went to work and did very well. You didn't need to go to college. So that was their way to come back. And they became heads of unions there. They became shop stewards, managers. And they really evolved and built that kind of thing.
Harrison enjoyed learning about the way life on Second Street worked, saying he's always been a student of history, though he did have a few challenges to work around when researching the book. Many of the people he covered never came home, and the letters their families had were heavily censored. Of those who did come home, many didn't want to talk about what they experienced.
Many of them never talked about it. There wasn't, whether because they were still waking up crying in the night or whether they were able to put it behind them and they didn't want to resurrect the memories, there really wasn't a reason to tell their families about what they had been through. And so they went on with their lives. And then the ones who did die, all their families had were the letters home that said, hey, hope everybody's doing fine. I can't really tell you where I'm at, but I want you to know I'm okay. And, that kind of thing. And so very kind of superficial. They're glossing over much of what was happening because they had to. So then there was another challenge. We had a major fire at the St. Louis archives back in the 70s, and we lost about 90% of the personnel records. Actually, we lost more than 99% of the personnel records related to the people on Hero Street, but we lost something like 90% of the personnel records of people who fought in the war because of this fire.
Harrison says that as a result, he's indebted to the authors who came before him and analyzed different aspects of the war that were lost to the fire.
I also was able to find what are known as after-action reports and other eyewitness accounts. And what an after-action report is that there's an officer in every company whose job is really to keep a record of what happened that day. It's often very dry, but even in that, you can find indications of where people are, what they're going through, how many died in a single day, to find reports from the hedgerows in France after we had landed at Normandy at D-Day and were pushing our way forward, the number of people. There was one unit that lost three officers. Their first commanding officer was killed in battle. The second in command becomes the commander, and he's killed before the afternoon is over. And then the guy who takes his place is killed the following day. They're going so fast. And we made mistakes. We sometimes bombed our own people. That's happened there, coming in and the breakout after Normandy. It's just so much. It took me about 5 years of very dedicated research to be able to put together this book. I really wanted to tell the story, and so I put the time in, and I'm glad I did. I learned a lot.
As we draw toward the end of the show, it seems fitting to turn our attention to the act that caused the end of the war. Before the United States military had the option to drop two atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they were planning a massive assault on Japan. To spare the lives of their soldiers, the bombs were used, and Harrison says that the targeted cities were chosen very consciously.
And it was dropped on a totally civilian target. It was meant, just as the firebombing of Dresden was meant, it was meant to inspire terror. The fact that we chose civilian targets was meant to horrify the nation into submission and to let them, to make them realize that their military could not protect them, that the war was over, and that they had to surrender. And when we think about it, there's still a continuing debate over was it the right step to go? What we do know historically is that the Japanese were continuing to fight, and even though there had been some tentative talks about peace, they were nowhere close to surrender if something like this hadn't happened. And as we contemplated an invasion of the Japanese islands, they had prepared the civilian population all the way down to school children to fight and to resist these oppressors. The mindset that the Japanese had was that the Americans and all of the Allies would rape their women and torture and kill their children, and that if you didn't fight to the death, then you would die a terrible death. And so they had been prepared in such a way that the estimates of the planners on the Allied side was that if we invade Japan, at least 1 million soldiers will die, at least 1 million. And they were so close to executing the plan to invade the islands that they had already made 500,000, 500,000 Purple Hearts in preparation to send to the families after those men died. So by dropping the bomb, did they shorten the war? Apparently, because we had a surrender within days. Was it the right thing to do? I don't think anyone can ever say definitively.
Right.
So what happens? You know, what do we learn and what do we avoid in the future? So far, at least, we learned not to use atomic weapons. That's a good thing. You know, from World War I, we learned and put a ban on chemical weapons. But, you know, as long as we continue fighting, there will be horrors. And in total, the estimates are some 60 million people during World War II. And I once heard the great writer, fantastic writer about World War II, Rick Atkins, talk about this. And he said, just to put that in perspective for you, that's one person dying every 3 seconds for every day of the war. Every 3 seconds.
Yeah.
One's dead. Another's dead. Those are horrifying numbers.
George Myers of Springfield was under General MacArthur's command in the Pacific. He was in charge of the radio on his ship when word came through about the bombs and Japan's surrender.
We were getting ready to make the invasion of Japan when, I know, we were out to sea somewhere when the notice came through over the radio, and we heard about the bombs, and then the end of the war come a few days later. I felt a little bit frustrated. I had a little bit of scientific training here at U of I, and I was very blown away with the idea of an atomic bomb. And I can remember I was talking to different members on our ship, and they said, oh, it's just another bomb. Well, no, I'm trying to say this is the beginning of a new age, an atomic age. And so then after the war was over, I was on a couple islands in Japan. We went to Yokohama and Liberty, and the thing that impressed me so much, the war had been over just a matter of a few weeks. I doubt whether these Japanese folks had seen any Americans, but we went on Liberty after dark, just two or three, four of us separately, and we didn't feel that we were in any danger at all. We might have been, but we didn't feel that we were, and I never heard of the Japanese taking out any of their anger on the Americans. We couldn't walk the dark streets of Chicago, let alone like we were walking through the streets of Japan immediately after the war. The other thing that I was so impressed about the Japanese, that we had just destroyed so much of that country. Ginza Strip was a very industrial and developed areas, and that was gone. This is Ginza Street. Well, there was nothing there but a park, green grass and everything. They picked up all the refuse and did something with it. We were in Japan and in China and other places, and the rubble from previous wars were still there. And here, a month after the war was over, Japanese had cleaned up the debris that in the areas where I was. They were very, very, very industrious people.
Carlos Harrison, the author of The Ghosts of Hero Street, was even more impressed by some of the Japanese Americans, as he researched the Mexican-American community of Second Street that embraced their American identity despite racism against them. He found the same thing in some of the Japanese Americans, who enlisted despite the World War II internment camps that were constraining their families and them.
You know, I mentioned in the book also, you know, there were other groups, there were other people. The Japanese Americans had one of the most highly decorated units in World War II that fought through Italy. It was a segregated unit. They packed all the Japanese Americans together. But these are kids who came out of the internment camps. This country had locked the Japanese up. And these kids said, no, we're part of this. We are Americans, and we want to do our part. And, you know, you think about it, and you go, oh, my God, your parents are being held. Your parents and siblings are being held in prison. And you're going off to defend the people who are imprisoning them. But their point was, we are Americans.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again. Some sunny day.
This has been a WILL special commemorating the 70th anniversary of the official end of World War II. I both produced and edited this show using new interviews as well as audio from some of the video oral histories that WILL conducted as part of their 2007 and 2008 World War II Oral History Project. You can find more of those videos, as well as more from each of the people featured in our episode, on our website at will.illinois.edu. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Amanda Hunnickfort, and this is Illinois Public Media, WILL AM 580.